extended board.
Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and the time is 10:15 a.m. on Thursday, May 8th, 2025. And today we've got Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Johnson, Representative Bynum, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Jimmy, Representative Stapp, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And we've got three bills before us today. We'll finish SB 80. That's the board extension bill. We've got House Bill 73, Complex Care Residential Homes. We'll take public testimony and set an amendment deadline. And then the last bill is House Bill 28. And that's the Teacher State Employee Student Loan Program. We'll take public testimony, set an amendment deadline. So coming back to our first bill, that's SB 80, extension board extension bill. If I could have Senator Bjorkman and his staff, Savea Bieber, please come to the table and put yourselves on the record. Just want to loop back to the committee and see if anyone had any questions. And we also have a written explanation from the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, which is in members' packets. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Foster and Co-Chair Josephson, members of the esteemed House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, representing the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. I appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 80 again. Just a brief recap of this bill. This bill re-extends four professional boards: the Board of Massage Therapy, the Marijuana Control Board, the Alaska Commission on Aging, as well as the Big Game Commercial Services Board. This is a cleanup item from last year. It backdates these board extensions back to June of 2024 and extends them again as amended in this bill. All of the board audits concluded that these boards operated in the public's interest by actively amending regulations, conducting meetings in an effective manner, and enhancing public safety.
Great. Thank you. Are one of you able to discuss the letter that we received from the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office? It was regarding Representative Allard's question about the $19.1 million in UGF. And if not, maybe, well, it doesn't look, oh, actually, we've got Kevin Richard online. We should probably go to him. It looks like he wrote the letter. Mr. Richard, can you put yourself on the record?
Through the chair, this is Kevin Richard, director of the Alcohol. Did prepare a response regarding the DGF funds that are on the fiscal note. This 19.1 general fund appropriation for the Marijuana Control Board is related to the impacts of Chapter 9 SLA 2021, which was SB 55, full year contribution to PERS from 2021. This is basically an employer contribution to when the decision was made that we had to basically put money in the PERS funds, the decision was made that the general fund appropriations were to made to licensing programs, but we were not to be paid by program licensees. So this is just a general fund appropriation to account for that SB 55 legislation.
Did you have any comments, Representative Ballard?
No, that's thank you. But I did, Co-Chair, have a question since he's on the line, if I may.
Sure, Representative Allard.
Okay. What was the gentleman's name again?
Mr. Kevin Richard.
Mr. Richard, this is Representative Allard. I have a question in regards to personal services. You said you have 10 full-time positions. One is a special investigator, two, a three special investigator, one, three license examiners, two, one program coordinator, two, one license examiner, and a local government specialist. On there, you have the special investigator and the three special investigators is a total of four. Did they pass work for the DPS?
Mr. Richard?
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is Kevin Richard, Director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. We don't pass work on to DPS. We handle the enforcement piece on our own, sometimes in conjunction with DPS or local law enforcement, but we don't I guess, share those activities?
Thank you. I think, may I, just a couple. It might take a little bit. Were the individuals that work for you currently as a special investigator, are the three special investigators, did they used to fall under the DPS umbrella? And now they've moved over to work for you guys. That's my question.
Through the chair, I believe at one point in time, enforcement was handled under the DPS umbrella, but that was before my time, and I'd have to research that. But I do know that they have been within AAMCO for quite a few years.
Okay. May I? So I guess what I'm trying to get at, if they used to work for DPS and they were under that umbrella, now they are not with DPS and they work for you, they don't carry weapons anymore. They don't have the ability to go in and do what they have to do when they work for DPS. Isn't it correct now that when they go in for an investigation or something's going down, that they actually have to call law enforcement and stand there and wait for them to come in to do the final process of arresting them, taking them away, whatever the context of that is? Is that accurate?
Through the chair, the enforcement officers of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office are authorized to carry firearms, and they do have certain law enforcement capabilities. However, generally we are focusing on the enforcement of the statutes and regulations and not arresting. But that's my understanding of how it is now. Under DPS, I'm not sure how they were structured, but in AAMCO, within DCCED, they are allowed to carry firearms, and they do have some capacity for enforcement outside of stat reg.
Just one last one, if you don't mind, Co-Chair. I was told they weren't. You're telling me they are, so I definitely need to find out for sure if they're allowed to carry firearms and if they are allowed to do the same thing law enforcement would do, and that is arrest the individuals. Because here's what I'm seeing. If we have these individuals underneath DCEED, but they're not allowed to do exactly what the DPS could do, why would we have them under DCEED and not have them under DPS where they can actually do the whole process all the way through and not wait on law enforcement to arrest, take them down, or things? So I guess I need another answer on that. It's not going to hold up this process today, but if it's possible, could you reach out, and unless you can find it while we're sitting here on committee?
And
thank
either
you.
If Senator Bjorkman or
maybe Senator Bjorkman knows,
or my office could reach out, unless you've got an answer, Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Allard. I don't know specifically the answer to your question. As a matter of process and what these boards typically do, they investigate and enforce licensing actions and are making sure that folks are following the law according to their license. It is, I think, an entirely different role of government when we start arming groups like this. Things have made the news in recent history in Alaska where folks from the EPA drew guns on Alaskans in an effort to enforce their type of federal regulation. Those types of things, when law enforcement is conducted by agencies that aren't specifically law enforcement agencies, people generally have concerns about that. So I think as a matter of public policy and role of government, be concerned about giving too much enforcement power to a licensing board like this one. They do have regulations that they can and do enforce. However, to give them the full force of a law enforcement officer, I think, is an entirely much larger step. Yep.
May I?
Representative Allard?
Thank you. And I think my intent here is that if we have law enforcement with DPS, if those law enforcement agents and investigators stay underneath DPS, they have the full force of the law to do what they need to do. As soon as you move them under DCEED, that ceases. So what ends up happening is you're making it twice as hard for the mission to be accomplished, because these investigators still then who are licensed investigators, but who are also law enforcement. They were pulled from the DPS to go work over at the DCED. They don't want to be there if they're not doing what their regular role was. So if you had the investigators fall under DPS is my goal to make happen, then you have they have the full force of the law behind them to do what they need to do. So just for clarification, it's kind of like the ATF. Great. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Just want to note that we also have Representative Galvin with us and also in the audience, Representative Ruffridge. Thanks for joining us. So with that, if there are no further questions of the Representative Hannah, did you have your, okay. I would entertain a motion, Representative Josephson.
So I move Senate Bill 80, version 34-LS0416/N, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Are there any objections? Okay. Seeing no objections, Senate Bill 80, which is 34-LS0416/N, is moved out of House Finance with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And with that, Senator Bjorkman, any final words before we move to the next bill?
Thank you all very much for your time.
Great. Thank you for hearing the bill. And we'll move on to our next item for today, and that is House Bill 73, that's the Complex Care Residential Homes. We've heard the bill once before in this committee, and we have reviewed the fiscal notes. I'd like to invite up Ms. Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. If you could put yourself on the record and give us a brief recap of the bill from there. Just so folks know, we do have online Dr. Bob Lawrence, the Chief Medical Officer, if we have questions. From there, we're going to go to public testimony. And then once we do that, we'll set an amendment deadline and put the bill aside. So with that, Ms. Ritchie, welcome.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Emily Ritchie, and I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I appreciate the committee hearing HB 73, Complex Care Residential Homes. The concept for this bill was generated through joint work by the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. HB 73 will create a new license type to help fill a critical gap in residential care options and improve outcomes for Alaskans with complex needs. These facilities would be a home-like residential setting where individuals with complex needs are provided 24/7 support by a multidisciplinary team. Currently, individuals with severe complex needs who do not qualify for home and community-based waiver services have limited options in Alaska relative to residential care. These include individuals with severe behavioral health and other co-occurring disorders who need more support than what is available through the current assisted living home setting, but who are not appropriate to remain treated in an inpatient setting or another institutional setting. Some examples of individuals who may benefit from this bill include youth returning to the state after being discharged from institutional treatment, seniors with dementia and mental health issues like schizophrenia that can't be adequately managed in an assisted living home or a memory care unit, and adults with severe and persistent mental illness and a co-occurring disorder like fetal alcohol syndrome and severe disruptive behaviors. HB 73 is an important first step in addressing these individual needs more effectively, and we can appreciate the committee's time on this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the recap. I'm going to go right into public testimony, and then we'll go to questions. So with that, I'll open public testimony on House Bill 73. That's the Complex Care Residential Homes. And if folks watching would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. And so we do have one person in the room and a few people online. Ms. Kim Champney, if you could put yourself on the record, just state your name and your affiliation, and thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you. My name is Kim Champney. I live in Juneau, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities. AADD is a statewide association of disability service providers and care coordinators. We have over 100 member organizations from Ketchikan to Kotzebue. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support for this bill. I represent the system that supports children and adults with significant intellectual and developmental disabilities. And our goal is really to help people live in the least restrictive environment with the greatest degree of independence. And our system is actually failing at this for a subset of individuals right now. And leaders like Deputy Commissioner Ricci are very well aware of this. They've been working very hard on solutions. We applaud that. And this bill is an outcome of their work. This bill creates the framework to provide stability and quality support to a group of people who are currently too often spending long periods of time at API or in other institutional and expensive settings. The traditional licensed group home is not equipped for a person with dual diagnosis with needs that might include preventing harm to self or others. And I hear stories like this at least weekly of providers calling and just really concerned. My hope is that this bill can make it to the finish line this session, maybe, so that the state can help, can keep forward momentum for this option. Thank you so much.
Great, thank you. We may have questions. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Champney? Representative Galvin?
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate you being here, and the idea that you represent care providers, it really brings to mind this question, and it's related to the bill that currently has a limit of 15 I think we call them residents at this point, per home. Mm-hmm. And having had multiple family and friends who might fit within this category of need, and so I was able to see many homes. And I guess my concern is the number of residents, and I wanted to know if you had any comment on that.
I appreciate that comment, Representative Galvin. And I am not an expert on the actual bill. My understanding is the department wishes to leave it as open-ended and flexible as possible because we haven't really defined what it's going to look like, what the target population is going to be. It is hard, very difficult for me to imagine 15 people with very complex needs all living under the same roof. You know, typically the smaller the better in those situations. But I don't think that my understanding is the vision of what this is going to be is far along enough for them to really anticipate what it might look. There is a lack of access to clinical skilled support. So could a building be designed in a way that is like independent apartment spaces with clinical support on site? I mean, I think there's value in leaving it some flexibility in that, but I really appreciate and there needs to be, I think, people watching that we don't start, you know, putting 15 people in a building without thinking through what that looks like. But I do trust that the state understands that. They've been great partners.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. So the idea is we just hope that with this understanding, you feel that confident that there would be some attention paid to the chaos that could happen with 15 or so of these dual diagnoses residents in one, under one roof. I appreciate that, hearing that. And that I think that makes sense to me, knowing that design of the facilities could be especially lined up in a way that would allow for quiet spaces, et cetera. I'm very sensitive to this, having been in so many of these homes, and want to bring it to the committee's attention that we are, you know, while we're trusting the state to come up with the right call here, it also is going to be an important call to make as we want to improve the opportunities and the access. And right now what we have is not okay. I understand that too, that API is not the right place for so many, and we need to make sure we have another option. But I am concerned about that number of residents. And if you don't mind, Chair Foster, I have one follow-up question.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And it's regarding the age of residents, if you have any commentary around whether it makes sense to specify that one style or one design would be 0 to 18 or whatever the age group is, and then something that would be for adults.
Yeah. Again, I think at this point being flexible, because then there would be a whole regulatory process that would really define those settings, because we do have youth that aren't even old enough to live in group homes that we're getting variances for because there's nowhere else for them to go, and they're cycling through it, you know, from API to group home to API, and we need something in between. So I think that the intent and the conversations I've been a part of is to just leave it fairly flexible. The service provider community is going to be watching very, very carefully these regulations because we don't want to set up a situation that people are going to fail in. So again, I don't feel confident enough to say, oh, we should only have this age, because I think this allows for some evolving kind of vision.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much for your comment. Thank you. Chair Foster.
Thank you. I don't see any Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I'm not going to I think Ms. Champney has already shared some of her expertise, but she is a champion, not just in her name, an advocate extraordinaire for people with wide range of needs, from families with young children to adults with significant needs. And I think as she was speaking, you know, without, revealing any confidences, I know that we have a variety of attempts to serve this population. And it's a really diverse population, including an apartment complex where the adult residents have supervisors living on in the complex. So I think that's the kind of example of 15. You might have 15 adults in studio apartments, but care on there, different from five people in a group home setting or five adults living in a five-bedroom house. So I think that Kim could probably give us examples of each of the kinds of vision of different age group and different needs, but we know how exhausting it is to relive all these folks that she spends every day advocating for and trying to problem solve. And as a result, we have folks in this community living all over with all kinds of care that Kim has assisted in trying to piece it together so that your family can stay intact or services can be provided and respite care is available. And I really appreciate you being here and advocating for this and knowing that it's going to look really different in different communities and serving different populations. And I am sure that you have a specific case in mind of who you are working towards bringing home, as well as continuing to serve those who are already here and have found something that's patchworked together. But thank you for advocating for this.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. I just want to note, I know that Representative Shiragi had another meeting, and just want to note that he's here with us. Thanks for being here. Also, we're going to jump. I don't think we've got anyone else in the room here who would like to testify, so we'll go online. And the first person up, it looks like we've got, maybe five or six people. Mr. Philip Tafts, and then let's see here. I think there's a mixture of some folks that are in departments, but I think the next person would be Kermit Olson and Jared Cossin. So first we've got Philip Tafts calling in from Anchorage. Mr. Tafts, T-A-F-S, if you could put yourself on the record, state your name and your affiliation.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and Josephson and the committee. My name is Philip Tafts, and I reside in Anchorage, and I'm a owner of a small agency, MethodWorks Alaska. I am a board-certified behavior analyst, and I've provided severe challenging behaviors consultation across the state since about 2012. And I'm calling in support of the bill today. This is a desperately needed in the community. As Kim had said, it's really very patchwork the way that we're doing this right now, and I can think of a bunch of cases, one in particular that I'm actually meeting on today, where the struggles are just with the funding and being able to patch to work. How do we actually get the support in these agencies to be able to support these individuals? And in this particular instance, it's an individual who's been institutionalized for probably 10 years in and out of different places. We finally found a place in the community. We've been able to somewhat stabilize the situation over the last 9 months, but now we're in
a funding situation where all of a sudden, because the funding was patchworked together, it's creating difficulties. It's a lot of stress on the organization and the team to be able to do it. And if we had a more systematic approach to this, we'd really be able to do a lot better in stabilizing individuals. And the cost savings are just tremendous as far as having somebody at a lower acute level versus being sent out of state or being hospitalized. And additionally, the way that the system is right now, I fear that it causes a lot of damage just between the community and the state, the different providers. It's very traumatic. There's a lot of difficulties within this. And again, because we don't have a systematic way of doing this and we're patchworking this together, it just can cause a lot of damage. It causes a lot of expense, and we've lost a lot of providers that just don't do this work anymore. So our pool of providers is very limited, usually very inexperienced, and it's just frustrating to see the system deteriorate. So I think this is a key step for moving this forward. And there's still a lot of work to do on this. So I'm fearful that if we don't advance stuff rather soon in this legislative session, we're going to lose the momentum that we already have to move this forward, and things are going to get worse in the community. And it's going to be very expensive in all ways. So I appreciate the committee's time.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? I don't see any questions. Thanks for calling in, Mr. Tafts. Next, we're going to go over to Mr. Kermit Wilson, calling here in from here in Juneau. If you could put yourself on the record, Mr. Wilson.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, legislators and House Finance Committee members. Thank you for your service to our fellow citizens in Alaska. For the record, my name is Kermit Wilson. I serve as the Executive Director to the Governor's Advocacy Boards and Council. Today I come representing the Alaska Board of Mental Health and the Advisory Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. These boards are statutorily charged with advising, planning, educating, and coordinating behavioral health services and programs funded by the state of Alaska. The boards are also tasked with evaluating federal and state laws concerning mental health, alcohol, and other drug and substance misuse prevention and treatment services, found in AS 44. HB 73 authorizes the Alaska Department of Health to establish a new residential license type related to complex care residential homes. These homes are designed to serve Alaskans with complex behavioral, medical, and or disability-related needs by allowing for ongoing long-term care in a home-like environment. People with complex behaviors such as severe and persistent mental illness, trauma disorders, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, traumatic brain injuries, autism, and other complex disorders are often caught between the cracks for receiving appropriate care. Many languish in expensive psychiatric hospitals, out-of-state treatment centers, or correctional institutions for longer than is necessary, because the community providers are not equipped to receive and treat them appropriately or with the right license type. By developing the appropriate regulatory standards, eligibility criteria, license type, and funding mechanisms, communities will have the tools they need to serve this population of Alaskans in a more appropriate and cost-effective way. We encourage the passage of HB 73. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Do we have any questions? Seeing no questions, thanks for calling in. For folks testifying, if maybe you could get a little bit closer to the mic. Sometimes I think it's a little bit better if we're not on speaker, just to get the audio on our side a little clearer. Next up, we've got Mr. Jared Kosin and then Michelle Baker. Mr. Kosin, if you can put yourself on the record, looks like you're calling in from Anchorage.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jared Kosin, and I am the President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. The Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association supports House Bill 73. Currently, one out of every seven hospital beds in Alaska are tied up with individuals who no longer need to be in the hospital but are stuck with nowhere to go for continued care. We believe creating a new service delivery mechanism like complex care residential homes will help with this problem and reinforce access to care at an appropriate lower level setting in the community. We recognize this is just the first step for establishing access to this type of care, but we think it's an important step. For these reasons, we support HB 73 and urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question, Mr. Kosin, from Representative Galvin.
True, Co-Chair Foster, thank you. And thank you very much, Mr. Kosin, for coming on board here. Nice to hear what AHA is thinking about this. You mentioned 1 in 7 current hospital patients. What would the total be then of the number of Alaskans who are waiting for a spot like this?
Through the chair, Representative, thank you for that question. And I'm smiling because I expected it. And unfortunately, we do not have our data broken down to the detail where we could reasonably assess exactly how many people would fit this category. But what I can say affirmatively is anything will help. When we're talking about this number of hospital beds and this number of people occupying those beds that truly don't need to be there, any system improvements upstream and downstream are going to improve the situation for the overall healthcare system, and that's why we feel so strongly that this bill is a good bill.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Kosin. And if you happen to come across a little bit more detail on that 1 of 7, I think, you know, maybe to estimate what the average occupancy is, or maybe if you work with the hospitals and get that. It's just always interesting to hear what the target number is, knowing that that's only the hospitalized Alaskans. We know that there are many others who this would not apply to, but in other words, there are many others who need this sort of home in addition to those who are currently in the hospital and waiting for discharge. But I just am always curious to know what our target is as we think about our goals so that we can make sure we're growing the right number of seats, if you will, in these sort of a care facility. So thank you very, very much for giving us your testimony.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Representative Foster. Mr. Kosin, I'm going to ask a question similar to Representative Galvin's, but I'm going to narrow it. How many hospital beds are there in Alaska?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. To just be totally candid with the committee, I wasn't expecting follow-up questions, so I don't have all of those numbers at my fingertips. So I'm happy to follow up personally because I could go ahead and give you what I reasonably remember, but I'd rather only provide accurate information for the record. So I'm happy to talk to you offline and answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Representative Ballard.
I'm going to follow up to Representative Hannon's question. I know you want us to talk about it offline, but a lot of times I feel that the public needs to know that too. Do you think that the next time, or maybe today, I don't know, could you see if you can shoot an email somewhere and see if we can get that today so we can just put it on public record?
Sure.
I know.
Through the chair,
I'll
do one more better for you for you guys. I've been frantically digging through my desk, and I can tell you our assessment of the number of acute care hospital beds, which would not include specialty hospitals. So specialty hospitals would be military and behavioral health. So if you're truly talking about acute inpatient beds, it's approximately 1,491, so right around 1,500 hospital beds in the state.
Representative Ballard?
And that's great. We know you're estimating, and we just really appreciate you putting that on the record. Thank you so much.
Okay. Of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Kosin. Our last testifier is Michelle Baker, calling in from Anchorage, if you can put yourself on the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Baker. I am the Executive Vice President for South Central Foundation's Behavioral Services Division. I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 73. South Central Foundation cooperates the Alaska Native Medical Center in partnership with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And every day there are many adults and children awaiting discharge from the hospital who are not able to leave because they have complex medical and behavioral health care needs, and there is not adequate programs or services to discharge to in the community. And this legislation would help jumpstart the process of standing up these community-based facilities to support individuals with complex care needs. There are many examples of individuals that receive care at the Alaska Native Medical Center supported by South Central's Behavioral Urgent Response Team. One example is an adult who had a long-standing history of bipolar disorder that was successfully managed on an outpatient basis for many years. And this individual developed behavioral difficulties due to dementia, and family members were no longer able to care for this person at home due to assaultive behavior. And this individual spent 5 months at the Alaska Native Medical Center while the care team worked to find appropriate community-based placement. There are many more examples of adults and youth with various complex care needs in hospitals in Alaska and in out-of-state facilities because we don't have programs and services to support them in-state. The example that I shared with you, has a cost for both providers and payers, such as the state Medicaid program. Having services like these in this bill in Alaska would provide better care to individuals with complex care needs, keep them close to their families and support systems, and would save the state money. I have one recommendation that would strengthen this bill that would need to be done through an amendment. If you turn to page 3 of the bill, go to section 4, line 10, remove the words, not more than 15. This patient census limitation is lower than allowed by the Institute for Mental Disease Exclusion, also known as IMD exclusion for adults, which is 16 for adults, and there is no limit for children. The program size can be managed through regulatory rulemaking, like other behavioral health residential services outlined in the 1115 waiver regulations. And removing not more than 15 will create more flexibilities as providers partner with the state to plan for clinical service delivery. In closing, South Central Foundation supports House Bill 73, and we want to thank you again for your consideration of this bill and to the Department of Health and DFCS for your leadership on this issue and for introducing this much-needed policy framework. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We've got a question, Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. When you spoke to the amendment and deleting the number 15, and then you said the IND recommendation, and you gave a number, was it 16 as in 16 or 60 as in 660?
Through the chair, Representative Henning, the IND exclusion limit is 16 or less, 16 for adults, and there is no limitation for children.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. My question is similar, Ms. Baker. What's the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed, and maybe that was carving out a specific group of people, I'm not sure, but they were concerned about that size being too much. And I'm concerned about what I thought was the goal of this particular style or model of home was for it to feel like a home-based environment, and so I just wondered if you would comment on that. Perhaps I have the wrong vision in mind anyway, and tell us what works there for your patients as they discharge.
Yeah, so through the chair, our comments are to create as much flexibility as allowed, and as a clinical service provider, we want to work with the state and other partners to talk about how do we make these services more home-like through regulations, through licensing requirements, and you know, whether that's through, you know, cottages or different units in a facility that support individuals. I think we're really early in the planning phases, and there's more work that needs to be done in this area, looking at the data and the clinical service delivery models.
Thank you. That makes sense. Thanks to you so much, Ms. Baker.
Thank you. I'd like to note that we have with us Representative Sadler. It looks like we've got some guests here today. Just want to welcome you to House Finance. So do we have any questions for Ms. Baker, any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for calling in. Oh, we've got one, Representative Nelly.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. Thank you for taking the time for your testimony, and I just wanted to ask a question because I noticed here it says for complex care residential home, and that mostly sounds like it's in urbans. Would this be opening it also to the rural areas where people can open complex care residence home in the village?
Through the chair, you know, this framework allows for a new license type, and you know, if organizations or rural areas, you know, have the staff that, you know, will be created through regulation and licensing type to operate these programs in rural Alaska, that would be the hope and the goal, is that there would be as much flexibility as possible to operate these throughout the state. But there's a lot more work that needs to happen with the state and with clinical providers to get to that level of detail.
Goyana, I hope that door can be open here soon. And it's good to get this kind of conversation going. Goyana.
Thank you, Representative Jimmy. I don't see any further questions for Ms. Baker. And so is there anyone else online who would like to testify? I don't think there's anyone else. So with that, I'll go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 73. And if anyone would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. So that next takes us to questions. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I was just wondering, you know, the suggestion that was made by the testifier talked about in the definition putting not more than 15. Striking that from the language. I was just curious from the sponsor of the bill and or staff or department what the impact of that may or may not be, and if it would impact the intent of the bill.
Ms. Ricci.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we are in support of that change to the bill. We believe, again, the intent of this is to create an umbrella. The unique needs that we are seeing in the world of complex care really vary depending on age, depending on underlying conditions, and the complexities of different patients that we see. So our preference and our intent, as we've talked about with stakeholders, is to really use a regulatory process to outline specific needs for the populations who are being met. Because the needs of a child with complex care may be very different than the needs of a senior or an adult. Additionally, we want to make sure that we're providing enough flexibility to organizations to be able to build out services in a way that is economical, meets the intent for a residential home-like setting, and falls within our payment restriction. So we believe rather than doing that, having that limit in statute, it makes sense to continue to build that out through regulations.
Representative Bynum.
Follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. There isn't anything in the bill that then would prohibit you from creating that regulatory framework to apply what you were just talking about. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, they're removing that would not inhibit us from conducting that,
thank
creating
you.
Those that framework through the regulatory process. Apologies.
No, thank you.
We've got Representative Galvin, Josephson, and Tomaszewski. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for being here, Ms. Ritchie, and bringing this forward. My question is related to this capacity, and what we heard, I think, from Ms. Baker was that she would prefer to see a 16, and she related that to some rule or something on the federal, it sounds like guidelines, and then to remove the maximum number of the youth. And so, and I really would defer to the experts on that, but I just wanted to know if you wanted to comment on that, firstly. Secondly, in consideration of that, and what I was thinking about, which is the ratio of care provider to whatever the needs are of the complex care resident, is there something that's already in guidelines based on whatever the specific diagnoses are, just to help allay any concerns around, you know, a massive group of people with one provider or anything like that? Is there already things in place to take care of that? So there's a part two on that question. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I would say part one, our understanding in discussions with South Central Foundation mm-hmm. is actually removal entirely of any sort of limit
okay.
related to beds is appropriate. So not maintaining 16 beds for adults with something separate for children, but just removing that, mm-hmm. that actually aligns with how the department has handled other types of licenses.
Okay.
Again, there is federal limitations, something called the Institute for Mental Disease exclusion, and it is intended to ensure that federal funds, primarily through the Medicaid program, are not expended to create large institutional care like what the state used to have with Harborview in the past. Mm-hmm. So that is really what that exclusion is intended to do. I think we all share in that intent, and those regulatory requirements will still stay in place. Mm-hmm. So we don't believe that they're necessary to maintain in this bill or in this statute because they will inform ultimately how these complex care homes are funded. And again, we can care for nuances related to what the clinical need is, what the patient need is, and what the providers can build out through the regulatory process.
Mm-hmm. And then part two was ratios, and if that's already embedded based on diagnoses, so there's no concern about that in terms of growing a 16-plus resident facility.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, at this point, we are early in the process, but again, I envision, and this is what we've talked about with stakeholders, as we begin to look at some of these different groups of individuals, those ratios would be determined based on clinical need and any other guidance that exists specific around the country. Again, I want to emphasize many of the kind of categories of complex needs we are seeing are very unique and very different from each other, which is why having that flexibility is very important. And I would envision that some of the needs that we're facing today may be very different than what we see in 10 years. So we want to make sure that we're giving the department and future leaders and providers the ability to be flexible in designing those needs.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Good morning, Ms. Ritchie. I just want to be certain that I understand the department's position. So, because I thought in response, I think, to Representative Bynum, you said that you would welcome an amendment, but then you've said the regulatory process is fine. And I'm looking at the letter from the Governor's Council that I think Representative Galvin cited to earlier. They recommend no more than 10 residents, and then they express concern about mixing adult and child populations. What is it that, what specifically, if you could amend something, would you amend?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I would amend lines 10 and 11 on page 3 in section 4 to remove reference to not more than 15 individuals. And again, remove that limitation on beds. I think I understand the concerns from the Governor's Council, and I think those concerns are valid in the context of providing care to individuals. I don't think that they are well reflected in maintaining that limit in this bill. I worry that if we put a bed limit into this bill as outlined by them, that will really limit providers' ability to stand up these services depending on the need in different communities. And that is what we've heard when we've talked with stakeholders or provider groups who are actually working to build out these concepts, is that they need flexibility in designing how you could care, how you could create residential settings in a way that is also economical. So again, going back to the idea of cottages or other ways where you may have more than 15 beds or 16 beds in a facility, but those beds are created for in a home-like setting that is small and appropriate to those individual needs. I would also add that integrating adolescents and adults in a residential setting is not something that the department supports, or and that would be cared for very clearly in the regulatory process. We believe that those needs are very different, and for obvious reasons, you would never want to commingle those populations.
Refugees.
Okay. Refugees. Okay, House Finance back on record. Mr. Anderson, would you mind just letting folks know we're back in there? Thanks. So there's a little bit of discussion about the possibility of moving the bill during this meeting. I think it would be good. I think there are two possible changes that have been discussed, and it might be nice to we can still take it up as soon as possible and move it as soon as possible, but maybe getting some things in writing, either doing a CS or doing the amendments. That way we know for sure that we're kind of crossing our T's and dotting our I's. We're going to go back to Representative Bynum. Did that? Or wait, Okay. Yeah. Representative Josephson, we're going to come back to you. And then we do have in the queue Representative Tomaszewski. Would like to get Ms. Ricci's thoughts on what the better route would be, whether or not that might be a CS or the amendment process. So, but let's come back to Representative Josephson.
Well, through the chair, I just wanted to follow up that the removal of the cap on residents runs opposite to the recommendation made by Caitlin Poindexter and Patrick Reinhardt at the council. And so I have experts all over the place on this, and so I don't know which to select. Just wanted to note that.
Ms. Ricci?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I would say, again, we have very thoughtfully, I think, listened and engaged with stakeholders and provider groups about their concerns related to this issue. I think at this point, again, we believe that we can care for the concerns that have been expressed through the Governor's Council through the regulatory process, and that is the most appropriate way to do that, while also ensuring that this bill provides a licensure type that can be flexible to meet the needs of other populations. And I think South Central Foundation's stated recommendation for an amendment is kind of a demonstration of that. We want to make sure that this statute and this legislation is effective. And we do have concerns that if we reduce that bed number even further, that we would be restricting ourselves in the future and we would not be able to fully achieve the intent of the bill.
In the on the list, I have Representative Tomaszewski, Allard, and Galvin. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I'm not going to talk about the number of beds. I'm just going to talk about the time frame. Mm-hmm. So it looks like we're asking you to apply to the U.S. Department of Health for these waivers, and it gives you a deadline of July of 2031, which is 6 years. Do we anticipate that long of approval from the U.S. Department of Health, or what is the average on applying for these type of waivers?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. As we have further discussed this bill and met with stakeholders, we actually believe that Section 6 and 7 of the bill, which speak to that longer unconditional date, that we can remove those and we can actually put in place a date of July 1st, 2026, will allow us to make this available faster while we work with Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to identify further funding sources from the Medicaid program to support that. There may be other funding sources that are available right now when we speak with our sister, the Department of Family and Community Services. I think they have individuals who could use access to these services immediately. And so we want to make sure that we are supporting them and getting this stood up because they may have alternative means to support this as well.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So it seems like it might be faster just to move this out of committee and have a simple amendment on the floor that, you know, would give us time to look at what works best for everyone. So, I mean, that's just an option, but leave that to the will of the committee. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Allard, and then Galvin and Hannon. Representative Allard.
Thank you. I might have to backtrack a little bit here. So I'm not quite sure, because the council has recommended a bed limit, that I'm not in favor of that too. Sometimes what I find is that we don't give some of the experts who I feel are on the disability council who's involved with this, and we give too much leeway to certain departments, not saying yours, and then it backfires. So if that's their high recommendation, I'm concerned that we're disregarding it if we lift up the bed limit. My other question would be, you keep referring to stakeholders. Are you talking about constituents? Are you talking about other hospitals? Who are your stakeholders? Because that's going to be a big deal to me of who is buying in and who is trying to sell it for more beds, because bottom line is, when you do that, there's money involved that's changing hands, and maybe that's why the stakeholders are saying what they're saying. So I want you to please explain to me who the stakeholders are.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Allard, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. So when I use the term stakeholders, it really means anyone that we have worked with who has who I think is grappling with this, with meeting the needs of these individuals. I will say that mostly from our perspective includes different types of provider groups, and because the complex needs span a lot of different providers, we have some really very different perspectives on what the needs are for these populations. So they include entities like My House in Anchorage, who we've talked to. You heard from Kim Champney with the association, the Alaska Association for Developmental Disabilities. You've heard from South Central Foundation and the tribal organizations. We've also heard from the hospitals. Philip Taft earlier, he represents providers who go in and work with other healthcare providers who are working with individuals to try to stabilize them and meet their needs. We have heard from this specifically from different hospital CEOs who are very frustrated because they have individuals in their hospital or in their emergency room who are not getting the care that they need. And then we've heard about this as well from some of our state employees working with the Department of Corrections and others. So we candidly hear about this frequently from the people who are meeting, from the organizations and providers who are meeting those individuals' needs right now and can see that there are gaps that they're unable to meet effectively. So it does span. I would say in relation to the beds, it is unusual to have a bed limit for a facility like this in statute. If you look at some of our assisted living home beds, the limits are outlined in regulation. If you look at some of our other license types, those are also further outlined in regulation. My concern with having a lower bed limit is that it would really limit the effectiveness of this bill, because there are going to be populations where, you know, maybe the needs are so severe that you have fewer than 5 individuals in a home. I could imagine that for children. But you may have other populations right now where there's a series of adults, and it would not be economical for providers to meet those needs with a 5-bed limit. That's why providing that umbrella and letting the agency outline what will work best after engaging with these different provider groups and representatives from the communities will allow us to have that flexibility in meeting these needs. I'm concerned that if we have a lower bed number, we will come back a year or two from now and say we need to remove this because we practically can't stand it up. That's my concern.
Okay. May I?
Follow up.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say, for example, there's someone in a homeless shelter. I'm only going to speak of the municipality of Anchorage. If there's someone in a homeless shelter that absolutely needs help, we might have delayed their care, which could be brutal. It could be life-threatening because we don't have enough beds. You're also implying or saying that there's a potential that there's someone under Department of Corrections. They can't get the care they need because we've limited the beds. There might be somebody sitting in the emergency room, literally just staying in the emergency room, nowhere to go, that we have to release because we don't have a bed.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that is correct. I would add that there are some programs right now that support this population, particularly for adults. Those tend to be the general relief program. Mm-hmm. Many of these individuals are in assisted living homes covered by the general relief program, and that is appropriate for some of those individuals, but there's a small section of individuals there who need far more support than what can be provided in those general relief assisted living homes. And without that support or without a place to go, like these complex care residential homes, they frequently engage in very disruptive behavior and they end up right back in the same cycle.
Okay. And just may I, co-chair?
Representative Allard.
So we're trying, but you did agree that children shouldn't be with adults. We're going to keep that separate, but I hear what you're saying, and I'm in agreement. So thank you for putting that clarity for me, and it makes a difference because I was like, well, I mean, what if we put 30 people and they're not getting the care? But that's not really the issue. The issue is we do need them. We do need the more beds, and we need the flexibility with the department.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, and any response? Otherwise, we'll go to the next question. No? Okay, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I appreciate the previous conversation, and I'm still hung up a little bit because the first presentation that we were given, and I'm looking at multiple slides, all of which talk about fewer than 15 residents,
home-like environment, continuing basis up to 15 residents with mental, behavioral, medical. These are all what was presented initially by your department, and perhaps this was a panacea for you all where you thought this would be the perfect setting if we could do it. And then we heard from Ms. Baker, 16 would be good, and then eliminate the number for the children size of the care facility, the residential setting, I should say, because that's what it's trying to be. So I'm struggling, but trying to, because the only language that I heard that would support much larger is not economical. That I understand. So what I'm hearing is that we want to make sure that those stakeholders who want to see the scale allow them to make the decision, the investment, to open a facility like this. We want to make it possible so that they are willing to do it. My guess is that is why this has changed. This meaning your perspective on size. And I can't, what I'm trying to study is to understand if, because I don't want to stop us from more facilities. I understand that we need more residential facilities, but at the same time, I also want to be respectful of your initial, I think it was your programmatic presentation based on what you thought would be the best possible opportunity, and now we're sitting with an amendment discussion because we're concerned that this best dream of our opportunity may not be creating the opportunity that investors are looking for.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I guess I would hesitate to use the word investors because these are not investors. These are providers who see a need along with the department and want to make sure that they can create, that they can meet that need effectively. And one of the things that I think I always remind our staff, or I try to, is that you can have the best policies on paper in the world, and if those don't translate into something that providers can offer and stand up, then we're not doing our job because our people can't get the care that they need. And so as we started in this process, we were very aware of the federal IMD exclusionary language, mm-hmm. and we wanted to make sure that we were not creating something that would in some way put us in a position of having that be an issue in the future when we went to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to discuss some waiver and Medicaid options. As we have worked through the process and as we've continued to engage with the providers and build out this idea, we've realized that that language is not necessary. It's not because those safeguards are not in place. Those safeguards are in place at the federal level, and those safeguards will be in place as outlined in regulation. But we believe that maintaining that number in this bill is not necessary and could actually create unintended consequences down the road that keep us from being able to stand up these services that people need. So that's really the evolution of this from my last testimony to now.
Thank you. And if I may, for the follow-up.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So the follow-up would be, why did you choose 15 originally?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that is because the federal that is because of the limit of 16 beds or less based on the Institute for Mental Disease Exclusion. And since we wanted to make sure that we could look at opportunities to tie Medicaid funding into this, we thought that it would be a stronger position to include that in the statute. Again, as the conversation has evolved, we've realized that that is not necessary to have in statute and could create unintended consequences that, again, keep individuals from being able to actually access these services because providers aren't able to build them out. So that's maybe a more succinct summary.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in support of us amending this bill in this committee because I think the subtleties of the bill and the practicalities, when we know there are a couple changes that would improve the bill's ability to successfully serve Alaskans. And I think one of the hesitations is when someone says, a group home, we each have a vision of the population and what that looks like. I think it's important to remember that what we say when we mean a group or residential home, there is 1,000 visions of what it means. So adolescents with self-harm behavior in a small residential facility is going to look very different than adults suffering schizophrenia in a supervised studio apartment living situation. So I can wrap my head around that we don't need in statute the bed ratio, because the variety of kinds of services are going to be so different, especially based on the kind of care providers that you need to have for them, right? So people who are self-harming are going to need far more care providers on duty 24/7 than adults where the regulatory of medication regimes for you to be stabilized are much more routine. I would like to see us, though, make these changes here, because we've had a couple of hearings and some complexity of dialogue, of understanding, and I think once we've wrapped our heads around that, trying to translate that to floor action, it would be shirking our duties. Once we've come to understand it, then we should solve this policy dilemma in the bill before we push it forward. But I'd like to see us do that in the next couple days. Mm-hmm. I do not have any incongruency with saying different of our advocacy groups are advocating for different caps because of the population that they've been working with and the vision they have to serve that group. But I do trust the department to say, we've got to fill a void. We need to move forward with this. I suspect that once regulations are in play, we'll have another bite at the apple of going, we want to stand up more like this and fewer like this, or this isn't necessary. So I'd just like to see us make the changes to the bill here before we push it out to the floor.
Representative Johnson.
Well, I think a lot of the things have been said that I had thought to say, but I appreciate what Representative to my left said. I think that we should deal with it here, not push it off. But I don't have any issues with allowing the department to establish the regulations as they go forward to clarify really what, I mean, complex care is going to be a spectrum. It's going to be a spectrum of different types of needs and different types of care providers that are going to be needed. And I don't know exactly how you are intending to do this, if you're going to do it where your regulations actually describe different scenarios that might have bed limits. You know, I don't know, and maybe you're still working towards what you're going to do on that. But I do think that we shouldn't hold this up from going forward because we're caught up in a number. But I do think that, you know, there is some, obviously we as a committee have some interest in making sure it's the best we can have going out. So I guess I want to see that finance does whatever we have to do, if that works within the schedule that the co-chair has.
I'm always open to the will of the committee. I am thinking that if we do an amendment process, we roll this in via an amendment, those amendments have to get rolled into a new CS anyway. So maybe just go straight to the CS, which is what Mr. Anderson was suggesting. That way it's something clean. We can have it before us. We know it's okay. We've had time to think about it, make sure we're getting all the details figured out. So if it's okay with the committee, we'll get that CS drafted up, and then we can take this bill up under bills previously heard as soon as possible, if that's okay with everyone. Okay, we'll do that then. Ms. Ricci, anything further?
Thank you so much again. I want to thank the committee for your time on this very important topic, and appreciate it.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we were going to, and we still will, take up House Bill 28, Teacher State Employee Student Loan Program. We did have this afternoon's 1:30 meeting become empty, and so I think what we're going to do is, sorry to Representative Story, if it's okay, if you don't have a conflict at 1:30, since that meeting no longer has anything in it, we have the capital budget, but that won't be taken up at that meeting. So what I'd like to do is push this bill off to that 1:30 meeting, and I don't see any opposition. So with that, we will go ahead and adjourn for the day, and we'll come back at 1:30 and take up House Bill 28, Teacher State Employee Student Loan Program. At that meeting, we do have public testimony. Let's see here. You know, we should at least allow the two folks who are available for a public testimony who have been waiting this whole time to testify. So let's do that real quick, and then we'll come back to the bill. So I'm going to go ahead and jump over to House Bill 28, open up public testimony. And if anyone would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. We don't have anyone in the room who would like to testify, to my knowledge. So we do have two people online. First, we've got Kay Riley in Juneau, and then Carrie Thomas, also in Juneau. Ms. Kay Riley, if you could put yourself on the record, state your name and your affiliation, proceed with your testimony on House Bill 28, Teacher and State Employee Student Loan Program.
Good morning. Thank you for letting us testify. It's been a wait. My name is Kay Riley. I live in Juneau, Alaska, specifically North Douglas. I am a state employee, and I am clocked out waiting to testify, so I'm glad I can do that today. I'm testifying for HB 28. I believe that the loan program would help Alaska recruit and retain public employees and teachers by enticing people with the possibility of easing the burden of their loan debt while working here. At a time when our schools, clinics, and agencies are facing critical staffing shortages, I believe that HB 28 offers a smart, targeted solution to these shortages. And as someone working in a severely understaffed division, we really need to do everything we can to recruit and retain. We are asked a lot. We are asked to work long hours and overtime due to overstaffing. And enticing people to come work for the state would ease that burden a lot. The bill would compete with other states who are doing the same thing, keeping people in Alaska and making it possible to stay and build a life here in this great state. Please vote yes on HB 28 and invest in the people who invest in Alaska. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Riley. I don't see any questions, so we're going to go over to Carrie Thomas, calling in from Juneau, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. This is Carrie Thomas, Acting Executive Director at the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. I'm not calling in for public testimony. I was online to answer questions about the bill if needed.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Well, we'll come back to this bill at 1:30. I was going to set two amendment deadlines, and I'll do it again at this afternoon's meeting, but one of the amendment deadlines will be for this bill. And we'll set an amendment deadline for next Tuesday, May 13th at 5 p.m. We'll also set the same amendment deadline for House Bill 105. That is the Mental Health Education in Public Schools. And so I'll announce those amendment deadlines at this 1:30, at this afternoon's meeting as well. Just I realize a couple folks are gone, so we'll do that. So again, we'll come back at 1:30 and take up House Bill 28. And if there's nothing else coming before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 11:32 a.m. Thank you.